Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Florida's governor and attorney general are weighing in on an ongoing sexual harassment scandal.
People say, well, why don't women come forward? Because they're intimidated. Because they're scared. Don't be scared.
Also this week, while scandalous headlines swirl around the Capitol, one panel of Florida lawmakers is reminding its members of the high standards they face.
For any of us to be here is a high calling, to be elected to this office by our constituents and sent here to do their business for them, making laws and passing budgets. That is a high calling.
We'll also learn why Florida State University suspended all fraternity and sorority activities in the wake of the death of a student pledge, and find why the abortion debate is again flaring in Tallahassee. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. Allegations of sexual harassment in Florida's capital are roiling the state legislature just as the lawmaking session is about to begin. Nick Evans reports the flying accusations are putting other elected officials in an uncomfortable position.
Seemingly every lawmaker is fielding questions about power and sex in the state capital, and more importantly, what needs to change in response. One senator has resigned and another is under investigation after a series of reports from Politico Florida. One of those reports cites six anonymous women making allegations of sexual harassment against Senator Jack Latvala. The Clearwater Republican is lashing out fiercely, claiming his innocence and calling the reports a smear campaign. After a recent cabinet hearing, Attorney General Pam Bondi echoes some of his criticisms.
Well, as a career prosecutor, I would say you have to come forward because someone has the right to face their accuser. It can't be done under the condition of anonymity. So you have to come forward. As a woman, I'd say, please come forward.
Bondi points to the power of the Me Too hashtag and other public accounts to force a nationwide conversation about sexual harassment. But in an environment where relationships and trust are a kind of currency, going public could jeopardize one's career. Bondi says she can empathize with those concerns, but that women should still come forward.
I can tell you, I can't remember some of the cases I prosecuted so long ago, but I can remember every single incident when I felt like I was inappropriately approached by a man. None of them were ever supervisors, ever. I worked for great bosses my entire career. So I've been very blessed in that way. But there are so many women, and people say, well, why don't women come forward? Because they're intimidated. Because they're scared. Don't be scared.
Florida Governor Rick Scott calls the allegations disgusting.
If you stop and think about it, the citizens of our state deserve much better than what we've read about in the papers. There's an investigation. There needs to be an investigation. We need to find out exactly what happened. And then if anybody's done anything wrong, they shouldn't be serving.
And he emphasizes the importance of maintaining avenues for confidential reporting of sexual harassment, pointing to a public records exemption he signed into law earlier this year.
Everybody should have a way that they feel comfortable on a confidential basis to be able to say this if they don't think somebody was appropriate. Last year there was legislation that I signed that would keep that confidential, but I think we've got to make sure we have a good process, and every part of government needs to be able to do that.
Confidential reporting has been a point of contention in the Senate after leaders had to backtrack on a set of changes that seemed to reduce options for filing complaints. Senate President Joe Negron insists that's not the case. While the state legislature works to get its house in order, the attorney general and the governor will likely continue to weigh in, criticizing misconduct and urging victims to come forward. But so far, there's little they're offering in terms of concrete action. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
The headlines have been full lately of stories about current and former government officials fighting accusations of poor behavior while in office. Some are facing investigations, others are facing time in jail. Now Regan McCarthy reports one committee is considering a number of new rules intended to help elected officials stay in line.
For any of us to be here is a high calling. To be elected to this office by our constituents and sent here to do their business for them, making laws and passing budgets. That is a high calling. And yet this committee of 18 of us out of 120 has the highest calling of being responsible to enforce the rules of the House as they relate to member conduct and ethics.
Republican Representative Larry Metz is the chair of the Public Integrity and Ethics Committee. His panel was in charge of investigating recent claims made against former Representative Daisy Baez, who resigned from her seat after recently accepting a plea deal following charges that she'd been misleading while running for office about where she lives.
And I think the way this matter ended, with the state attorney actually taking charge of a criminal investigation and seeing it through to a plea agreement, should be a warning to all who would falsify their credentials. And the way we handled it here, that should also be a message that the House will not neglect its responsibility to investigate valid complaints brought under our rules. And I think if members and candidates in the future hear this warning, we will not ever have to do this again, because I think they'll understand they have to comply, and they will.
Now, Metz's committee is working to pass new rules intended to protect against even the appearance of impropriety. Mount Dora Republican Representative Jennifer Sullivan is carrying a committee bill that would change how close to an election a person running for office can lend their name or voice to advocate for a cause.
I think that's what we're trying to do under this amendment and under this bill as a whole, and just in ethics reform and making sure that we're being above board in every way, shape, and form that we can, specifically during this crucial time of the election.
Sullivan says when lawmakers or candidates record public service announcements or are featured at public events while they're running for office, it can be confusing to the public.
In my opinion, as the person who's sponsoring and carrying it, I would prefer PSAs not to be on public television with candidates during the time between qualifying an election, because I think it can look like you're using a PSA to campaign in the name of community service and really kind of helping yourself at that time.
Under Sullivan's bill, those running for state office would be banned from taking part in these activities once the qualifying period begins. The legislation includes a carve-out for events or PSAs directly linked to a charity organization. The committee also discussed a bill that would do away with local government lobbyist registration programs and create a statewide registration system for those lobbying local governments instead. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Two Democratic lawmakers filed proposals this week that would seek to expand a pilot needle exchange program approved in 2016 for Miami-Dade County. Representative Chevron Jones, Democrat of West Park, filed the proposal in the House on Wednesday of this week. This was a day after Senate Minority Leader Oscar Brainin, Democrat of Miami Gardens, filed the Senate version of the measure. After years of discussion, lawmakers in 2016 passed a law that created that pilot needle exchange program in Miami-Dade to be run by the University of Miami and its affiliates. Supporters said the program would help prevent the spread of infectious diseases among intravenous drug users. Under the newly filed bills, which lawmakers will consider during the 2018 session, the needle exchange program could be expanded to other parts of the state. The proposals would allow the Florida Department of Health to establish needle exchange programs that would be administered by the department of entities such as hospitals, health care clinics, substance abuse treatment programs, or HIV and AIDS service organizations. Still to come on Capitol Report, in the wake of a student pledge death, all Greek organizations at Florida State University are on suspension, at least for now.
And I just feel like, for whatever reason, the message is not getting through. And I want this now to take a pause, as you said, and let's reflect on what we need to do about the culture of Florida State University.
Controversy flares over a bill regulating Florida's pregnancy crisis centers.
Maybe you think I'm too naive. I really thought this was a bill. It's not meant to be controversial. It's not meant to drive a wedge. It really is a choice bill, a choice for life.
And Florida lawmakers and the governor are already split on how much to fund the state's land buying program. Meanwhile, a long list of conservation projects hangs in the balance.
There are 2 million acres identified to be protected on the Florida Forever priority list. A conservative value of those is about $5 billion. So that begins to give you a sense of the immense need.
In the opening segment of this week's Capitol Report, we heard a couple of stories that could perhaps fall under the general category of elected officials behaving badly. But bad, even tragic acts are by no means confined to the political realm. Florida State University Greek fraternities and sororities are on indefinite suspension following the recent death of a pledge. Lynn Hatter reports FSU President John Thrasher is defending the decision, but not everyone is convinced he made the right call.
The organizations are banned from holding formal activities, including participating in homecoming, pledging, or hosting official meetings. Members will still be allowed to live in their homes. FSU President John Thrasher says the move is meant to send a message to the organizations.
That we've got a serious problem, and we need to deal with it, and they're part of the solution. And the sooner they can come to the table and we can all talk and find those solutions, the sooner this will be lifted.
Thrasher says he's tried talking to the groups before.
And I just feel like, for whatever reason, the message is not getting through. And I want this now to take a pause, as he said, and let's reflect on what we need to do about the culture of Florida State University.
The move comes after 20-year-old Pi Kappa Phi fraternity pledge Andrew Coffey died after attending an off-campus party. Tallahassee Police Chief Mike DeLeo says alcohol may have played a role.
Investigators have interviewed more than 50 people, and many additional interviews are planned. Although there are indicators that alcohol may have been a factor in this case, we are waiting for the results of an autopsy, so no cause of death has been determined.
Another issue law enforcement has to determine is whether Coffey was coerced into the actions that led to his death, says hazing expert Hank Neuer.
What will be interesting to me is if there was a coercion for the pledge to drink. I mean, that's really the bottom line, because then we're going into a criminal hazing issue.
Neuer teaches at Franklin College and hosts a website that tracks hazing across the U.S. and internationally. He's also written several books on the topic, including his latest, simply titled Hazing. In a separate and unrelated case, FSU student and fraternity member Garrett Marcy of Phi Delta Theta was charged with selling drugs after university police executed a search warrant at his frat house apartment. And shortly after, the university announced the arrest of 22-year-old student Daniel Martin, a member of Pi Kappa Phi, which is the same fraternity Coffey was pledging when he died. Both students are facing charges related to the sale and possession of cocaine. FSU President John Thrasher says the ban on Greek life will remain until there's a new culture in place for the organizations. But already the decision is generating controversy, with some hailing it as the right move, while others say it's a step too far. Neuer says a full ban may be a little much.
Sororities, in terms of the hazing deaths, in terms of the excesses that we see in fraternities, it's not the same there. And so to ban fraternities and sororities together, it doesn't strike me as the best policy.
He says it may be better to have a task force of faculty, staff, and students get together to assess the culture, because he says there are differences from fraternity to fraternity and school to school. And then there's the issue of money. Neuer says when Alfred University banned Greek life, they saw a drop in alumni giving and support.
They will lose alumni participation very quickly, but it's come back very quickly at Alfred. In my new book, Hazing, that's coming out March 1st, I have the Dean of Students from Alfred University doing an essay on what the effect was to get rid of the Greek system. And he says that they have joined other organizations. He thinks it's a safer campus, and that's his viewpoint. But certainly more schools are thinking about it.
The move comes as Florida State prepares to welcome alumni and parents for its upcoming homecoming events and game. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Siding with cardroom operators, an appellate court this week upheld a decision by an administrative law judge that Florida gambling regulators did away with rules governing controversial designated player card games without replacing the regulations, and that was wrong. The unanimous decision by a panel of the First District Court of Appeal in Tallahassee found that regulators dumped the rules in order to implement a new policy that would have banned the popular and lucrative games. Just by way of background, those regulators, namely the the state's Division of Paramutual Wagering have imposed an on-again, off-again mandate on these games for several years. Then a few years back, regulators decided the way the games were being conducted and not the games themselves violated a state gambling law, which prohibits paramutuals from acting as the bank. The division first floated a rule that would have banned the games outright, but they finally wound up issuing administrative complaints to about a dozen cardroom operators about the games. It seems all of this back and forth was just too much for the three-judge panel on the appeals court. The judges opined that regulators had overstepped their authority and were in effect giving themselves what the court called unbridled discretion to either approve or deny any internal controls set up by the cardroom folks. And then there was the matter of how much all this unbridled discretion would cost the cardroom people. The division folks had argued their regulations would cost the cardrooms about $200,000 a year. The cardroom industry pegged that regulatory burden somewhere in the neighborhood of $87 million a year. Lawyers for the cardrooms called the ruling a big victory for their side. A revived bill that wades into the abortion debate has passed its first Florida Senate committee, but not without opposition, as we hear from Sasha Cordner.
In March 2014, Annie Felkowski says she visited one of Florida's crisis pregnancy centers in Fort Myers.
I was 16 years old and scared. There was a chance I could have been pregnant due to lack of sex education in public high school and fear of asking my mom about the birds and the bees. I was scared, confused, and didn't know where to go. Every day on my way to school, I pass this clinic. It says free pregnancy test. So I went in.
At first, Felkowski says when she walked in, she felt at ease.
When we walked in, I assumed the women at the front desk were friendly. They were nurses. They were wearing scrubs. They asked why I was there, and I responded in a sympathetic manner. The room they took me into looked nothing like a doctor's office I have ever been in before. It looked more like a therapist's office. There was one big couch, a love seat, a tissue box, and a Bible.
But as she awaited the results of the pregnancy test, Felkowski says her experience soon changed when a woman came into the room to ask her questions.
And asked me questions like, if you're pregnant, do you know who the father is? She asked me his first and last name. She asked, what's the extent of your relationship? She told me, you aren't supposed to have sex until marriage, but if you do, you should be in love and in a committed relationship, right? She made me feel incredibly guilty. The woman came back and she had the test results. Like anyone in this position would be, I was incredibly anxious and I wanted to know. Before telling me the results, she asked what my religious affiliation was. I told her I was raised Catholic, but I wouldn't identify with any religion at this point. She gave me a pamphlet about Christianity. I reminded her why I was there and asked what the result of the test was. It was negative.
But even after finding out she wasn't pregnant, Felkowski says the woman didn't let up.
The woman then began to give me a lesson on abstinence and how I can still be saved despite the mistakes I've made. She gave me all sorts of pamphlets: abstinence, Christianity, adoption, horrors of abortion. She went on to explain the only form of birth control is abstinence and that all other forms cause cancer and or kill you. At the end of it all, she reminded me that she had all of my information and would be notifying my family and my school of my visit. I hope that no one ever has to go through this kind of coercive and not accurate experience.
I don't know the circumstances. I hate to have anybody have a bad experience.
That's Fernandina Beach Republican Senator Aaron Bean. He's sponsoring a bill opposed by Annie Felkowski that involves Florida's pregnancy support services. It was created by the Florida legislature in 2005 to provide counseling and support services to pregnant women, like free pregnancy testing, adoption, and referrals to community services. Every year since 2006, lawmakers have included in the budget between $2 and $4 million for the program. But the program itself was never an official Florida law. So Bean's bill would not only put the Florida Pregnancy Support Services program on the books, it would also provide some regulation for the contractors receiving state funds.
The bill requires the contract to include accountability measures, periodic reports. Contractors are required to have proper education, certification, and licensure. Any material given out by these centers needs to be current and accurate. Any information of medical nature must cite its source. DOH has the authority under the contract to monitor the contract and subcontractors for any of its infractions, as we do with all other contracts, the Department of Health or other agencies maintain.
The measure has the backing of groups like Florida Conference of Catholic Bishops. And while Planned Parenthood has no problems with the state regulation, the group does have concerns about at least one particular provision in the bill. It directs the Department of Health to, quote, subcontract only with providers that exclusively promote and support childbirth. That means it could preclude groups that provide information on birth control and abortion services like Planned Parenthood from receiving any state funds. Other opponents like Plantation Democratic Senator Lauren Book say they don't believe some of these crisis centers are providing medically accurate information either.
Unfortunately, I had to accompany a friend to a pregnancy crisis center a few weeks ago. And so I have some of the materials that were handed to a friend of mine. And do abortions cause breast cancer?
And while Book never got her question answered during the bill's first Senate hearing, Naples Republican Senator Kathleen Pasadomo says she feels the bill will do a good job of providing proper oversight.
It's not had statutory oversight. So when you think about it, if these organizations are giving inaccurate information, they don't have, you know, the state behind stopping this practice. So my feeling is if we codify the practice, what we're doing with the Department of Health having a mandate to review these the materials, then you will have medically accurate materials because there's much more gravitas to the fact that this is a statutory program.
Meanwhile, Bean carried a similar bill in the Senate during this past legislative session, but it died in the committee process. While his current measure has passed its first Senate committee, its House companion has not yet had a hearing. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
The Florida Agency for Healthcare Administration says 23 nursing homes have not responded to requirements of an emergency rule stemming from the deaths in September of Broward County nursing home residents after Hurricane Irma. The emergency rule, which has drawn legal challenges, called for nursing homes to have generators by November 15th that could power air conditioning systems. The homes were supposed to file plans by an October 31st deadline or apply for waivers. Hundreds of nursing homes have sought waivers, according to information posted in the Florida Administrative Register. The Agency for Healthcare Administration said this week, however, that 23 homes have not responded, and they could face fines of up to $1,000 a day or license revocation if they don't comply by the mid part of this month. The agency issued the emergency rule after 8 residents of the Rehabilitation Center at Hollywood Hills died September 13th, 3 days after Irma knocked out the Broward facility's air conditioning. 6 other residents died after evacuation. You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, Florida lawmakers and Governor Scott are $50 million apart when it comes to funding the state's signature land buying program. But whether it's $50 million or $100 million, the state has backed out of such proposals before, zeroing out funding for Florida Forever 3 years in a row. Meanwhile, Kate Payne reports millions of acres of land are at risk of development.
Senator Rob Bradley of Orange Park says his chamber will be committed to conservation this session. And as the Senate's new budget chief, he's in a position to follow through on that. He says lawmakers should listen to the 75% of voters who decided to use tax money for conservation land in 2014. He wants to spend $100 million a year on Florida Forever to do just that.
Senators, I look forward to working with all of you as we move through this session to make sure that we fulfill what I think is a pact that we have with the voters to take care of land acquisition.
But Governor Rick Scott wants to put forward only $50 million for Florida Forever, half of what Bradley wants. He says other environmental programs deserve more funding.
If you look at all these things, our parks, our beaches, all these things, we're focused on where we believe we can have the biggest impact.
With $50 million worth of wiggle room, it's too soon to say what kind of deal lawmakers and the governor will make, if any. Meanwhile, the backlog of proposed Florida Forever projects continues to grow. Will Abiger is with the Trust for Public Land.
There are 2 million acres identified to be protected on the Florida Forever priority list. A conservative value of those is about $5 billion. So that begins to give you a sense of the immense need.
One of the newest additions to the Florida Forever priority list is a massive 40,000-acre conservation easement along the upper Apalachicola River. Dan Tonsmeyer is the Apalachicola River keeper.
So it's a very important piece, and part of what we're trying to do is work on reconnecting some of the river to the floodplain, or connecting the river to some areas of the floodplain where there's been some impacts over the past.
Tonsmeyer says the proposal would close the gap in a patchwork of conservation lands that would almost completely surround the river.
Just about, it actually fills in a huge gap that has been sought by the state for many years.
Jim Carroll says the region is nearly untouched by civilization. He directs the Florida Forest Service.
To stand on those bluffs at night and to look out over that river and not to see lights, not to hear roads, a few airplanes flying over, but there is almost no place like that left in Florida.
But if lawmakers don't fund Florida Forever, the program's trust fund will continue to dwindle. And without the money to close the deals, private landowners will be free to build condos, strip malls, and parking lots, even after the state has singled out the areas for protection. David Clark is the state lands director at the Department of Environmental Protection.
Putting a property into the Florida Forever program does not put any kind of restriction on it. So, yes, absolutely. Those landowners own those properties, and they can do anything that is inured with them with private property rights.
And Clark says some landowners aren't interested in selling.
Not every landowner within those projects are willing sellers. I know that seems contrary to, wait a minute, they're in Florida Forever. Yes, they're in Florida Forever because perhaps a NGO has applied to have this large landscape put into the Florida Forever program.
There are millions of acres of land on the priority list scattered all across the state. Looking at a backlog of that size, $100 million is a drop in the bucket, let alone $50 million. But Kent Wimmer with Defenders of Wildlife says the state has to start somewhere.
It's not going to be enough, but it's what we need to get these major land conservation projects done.
Senator Bradley's proposal to allocate $100 million annually passed its first committee stop on November 6th. There's plenty of time for that number to change as lawmakers prepare for the 2018 legislative session, which starts in January. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. And join us again next week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.